This week, we discuss a new technology in time. How does time affect our minds? And how do our minds affect how we live? Then, we're going to hear from illustrious brother Stephen L. Harrison in an all-new Masonic Minute. What exactly was the Star and Garter? Here's a clue. It's not the Star-Spangled Banner, as many passively assume. Then, we'll hear some interesting facts about that great treasonous, quote-unquote, brother, Benedict Arnold. In the end, we'll wrap it up with an article about breaking the paradigms of the Knights Templar, when a past eminent commander gives his thoughts about the fading popularity of KT drill teams and how we could possibly save the organization by implementing a few changes. All this and more. Stay tuned.
Welcome back to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. Here's your host, Brother Robert Johnson.
Welcome back. This is episode number 502. Happy 4th of July. I hope everybody had a great holiday. And you really thought about those values that we hold dear in Freemasonry that are really exemplified in this thing called the Great Experiment. Before we dive too much further into the episode, I want to go ahead and thank our producers, fellows, contributors, and legacy partners. Thanks to them for assisting us in bringing you Masonic Education 50 episodes every year for the last 10 years. That's over 500 episodes now. We're at 502, and it's all for a great cause, bringing Masonic light to Masons out there who are interested, and of course, anybody else interested in the craft in general. As you heard in the top of the program, we've got an interesting one for you this week. Before we dive into this education, coming up on July 12th, I'll be doing the Masonic Pub Crawl, Freemasonry in America and its Colonial Tavern Beginnings, and that's going to be sponsored by Olive Branch Lodge number 114. That is Brother Kevin Homan, who is the author of one of the pieces that we're reading this week. After that, I'll be doing something special on August 1st, which will be the Business of Freemasonry, a little webinar sponsored by Craftsman Online. And then we've got other things coming as well. Now, to return to that message about the 4th of July, the Declaration of Independence, and all of the things that we all envision, this patriotic vision of the United States of America. In just a few short years, it will be the 250th anniversary of these United States, or of the Great Experiment. It's no secret that America has its struggles, spiritually, philosophically, and more. And one of the things that assisted these United States, this Great Experiment, in becoming what it is today, is through a Masonic influence. And that Masonic influence is crucial when we think about ideas of freedom and liberty and the pursuit of happiness and all of these things. Because of this, we believe that Freemasonry is a repository for these ideas. And if you want to know more about how to turn this mental attitude on through Freemasonry, through what we already teach, just by doing some exercises on the working tools of Freemasonry, in the Blue Lodge that we all know and love, check out MLS2026.com and check out the document and guide that the Masonic Legacy Society has put out. I think you'll find it very interesting. And in episode number 448, we actually did an interview with past Grandmaster Akram Elias on the Masonic Legacy Society, so you can check more out there. Also, the Fraternal Review, March 2021 issue on the Masonic Legacy Society was also a huge hit, and you can check that out also, and that is on MLS2026.com. Scroll to the bottom of the website and click on In the Media, and you can find both of those things there. Now, you know me, I'm deep into the science, and I've started to bring some modern news and how that is connected to something in Freemasonry. Now, not all the time, but most of the time, it's pretty cool to connect these things. One of the items that we ran across this week came from the physics area, and the title of this first part here that we're going to connect, we're going to talk about time. And so this is an atomic clock that could revolutionize space travel just past its first test. the Deep Space Atomic Clock could help spacecraft reach distant destinations on their own. This was published just a couple days ago at 11 a.m. by Maria Temming. An atomic clock that could transform deep space travel has successfully completed its first test run in space. NASA's Deep Space Atomic Clock, which launched on a satellite in June of 2019, outperformed all other clocks in space during its first year in orbit around Earth. The clock, DSAC for short, was at least 10 times more stable than clocks on GPS satellites, which makes it reliable enough for futuristic space navigation schemes, researchers report online, June 30th in Nature. To navigate the solar system today, space probes listen for signals from antennas on Earth and then bounce those signals back. Ultra-precise refrigerator-sized atomic clocks on the ground measure that round-trip time, which can take hours, to pinpoint a spacecraft's location. A future spacecraft carrying a toaster oven-sized DSAC could simply measure how long it takes a signal from Earth to arrive and calculate its own position. Untethering deep space navigation from Earth could someday enable self-driving spaceships or GPS-like navigation systems on other planets. The Deep Space Atomic Clock is so stable because it keeps timing using electrically charged atoms or ions rather than neutral atoms, says Eric Burt, a physicist at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, or JPL, in Pasadena, California. Bottling ions with electric fields prevents those atoms from bumping into the walls of their container. Such interactions cause the neutral atoms in GPS satellite clocks to lose their rhythm. By comparing the Deep Space Atomic Clock with the U.S. Naval Observatory's Hydrogen Master, or Master Clock, on the ground, the researchers found that the space clock drifted about 26 picoseconds, or trillionths of a second, over the course of a day. That's comparable to ground-based atomic clocks currently used for deep space navigation, says DSAC Principal Investigator Todd Elley, also at NASA's JPL Laboratory. So this is really cool, right? We think about not just time here, but this idea of traveling in the future throughout our solar system, a really fascinating concept. But as we talked in this article, something becomes interesting. People don't always know what comprises a second and what is that measurement. We've taken this all the way down to this super scientific level, but our ancient brothers really looked at the 24 hours in the day, measured, of course, using several different early instruments, from counting thumbs to the horizon, to using sundials, and more. In Freemasonry, we use this thing called the 24-inch gauge, which allows us to separate the day into three equal parts, where we say we have 8 for the service of God, 8 for our regular vocations, and 8 for refreshment and sleep. A famous Freemason, Benjamin Franklin, actually had a 24-hour calendar or schedule for his day, and he tried to lay out his day in this way, accounting for every hour of every day so that there would be no wasted time. Now, I've tried this myself, and in fact, I've used this method for several years now, almost 10. And what I found interesting is that over time, I put less emphasis on exactly what I'm trying to strictly do on the schedule, my 24-hour schedule, and I put more emphasis on remembering and being cognizant of what I'm supposed to be doing. This leads me to be much more productive than getting hung up on what I'm supposed to do hour for hour every day. And so now we're talking about kind of the psychology of time and how we as humans manage our time. It's often been said that we don't have time for something, but really what it is that we haven't made time for that thing. It puts the onus back on us as people to have that responsibility in saying, not that I don't have time for that, but rather, I don't want to make time for that right now. And sometimes that hurts a little bit. So as I was looking at things about time and attitudes about time, something I came across was a cool article called Stoic About Time by Kristen Wilson Slack. And she wrote this back in 2017 for the Masonic Philosophical Society. Let's have a read. Quote, "True happiness is to enjoy the present without anxious dependence on the future, not to amuse ourselves with either hopes or fears, but to rest satisfied with what we have, which is sufficient, for he that is so wants nothing." the greatest blessings of mankind are with us and within our reach. A wise man is content with his lot, whatever it may be, without wishing for what he has not. End quote. Seneca. In a recent Masonic Philosophical Society meeting, we discussed the likeness of Stoicism and Freemasonry. Seneca, Zeno, Epictetus, and Marcus Aurelius all took center stage. It was a lively discussion, and the argument that Stoicism and Freemasonry are the same was extremely compelling. As I always do, I went on my own journey to rediscover what I had learned in school about the Stoics. With what I knew about Freemasonry, I felt that I was well-armed to learn some new ways of looking at the Stoics. I first went to TED Talks, where I always find a wealth of great ideas and food for further thought. There was an excellent animated video on the Stoics by Massimo Pigliucci, entitled The Philosophy of Stoicism. It's a very well-done quick course on the Stoics. Another excellent TED Talk on Stoicism is by Ted Ferriss, Why You Should Define Your Fears and Not Your Goals. This is about 13 minutes long and is a very practical look at why Stoicism is beneficial and how you can use it in daily life. What was very interesting was a single quote that Ferriss said helped him change his life. Quote, "We suffer more in imagination than in reality." End quote. Huh, I thought. Of course we do, but why? Another recent reading foray brought me to another idea. Time. We humans understand time only superficially, as it applies to us. Our brains are wired to understand and extrapolate possible futures, opportunities missed in the past, and move our lives to live in synchronicity. There are factions of large people, including myself at one point, who thought that living in the moment was the key to being happy. I now don't think we're wired that way. In a recent article in the New York Times, author and professor of psychology Martin E.P. Seligman agrees, quote, "We aren't built to live in the moment," this is his article, and it examines how our minds work and why. He and his co-authors have outlined this process in their book, Homo Prospectus. The article and the book are really discussing the philosophy of Stoicism to make it through life. We are subjects of time. What really solidified this for me was listening to a recent Radiolab episode, which was a repeat of their first season discussing time. In it, the two podcasters discussed the idea of time and living in the moment. Robert Krulwich takes his co-host on a journey of reason. Our mind does not process data at a time it is created. Smell, sound, and light. These are all generated by something and transmitted over some distance to our surroundings, where we pick it up via our senses, and whereupon it is interpreted by our brains. This distance traveled takes time. It is not instantaneous. Our minds process. Speed is only a matter of relativity, ergo we are never experiencing the moment. We are always processing memories, and memories are always subject to misinterpretation. It's no wonder we fear. We cannot live in the moment, and must always interpret the past to create possible futures. Truly, like we never really touch anything due to the molecular distance between surfaces, all that we have is an interpretation of our surroundings, received and processed and passed, to guide us in our futures. Spending the time to put emotion into it grounds it even further in memory. To pull ourselves out of time is impossible, and thus living in the moment is impossible. Ergo, we need a tool to bring us around to dealing with these memories in such a way as to not freeze us in our tracks. We are brought back to, again, the wisdom of the Stoics. A bad feeling is a commotion of the mind, repugnant to reason and against nature, stated Zeno of Citium. Our modern psychologists agree, quote, "Homo Prospectus is too pragmatic to obsess on death for the same reason that he does not dwell on the past. There is nothing he can do about it. He can become Homo sapiens by learning to see and shape his future, and he is wise enough to keep looking straight ahead." End quote. From Homo Prospectus by Martin E.P. Seligman, Peter Railton, Roy F. Ballmeister, and Chandra Sripada. So this was a cool look at the idea of Stoicism and time, and how we actually don't ever really experience anything right now. Everybody says live in the now, right? Including myself. I'm always thinking about, am I truly being present right now? And I think what perhaps we can take from this is that although we can't truly live in the now because we're always processing, we can try to live as close to it as possible in those milliseconds, those picoseconds, when we're with somebody to give them instantaneous feedback on what they're talking about, whether through emotional cues, physical cues, right? So we're kind of living in the moment, and that's very important. Something else I should mention here is that just last month, there was an excellent issue of the Fraternal Review on Stoicism and Freemasonry. I'll make sure I put links to that in the show notes, as well as links back to these other articles related to time. For our Craftsman Plus out there, is a contemplative exercise. What I'm going to ask you this week is, what is your biggest struggle with time? I want to leave it broad, because I don't want to lead you on examples to, you know, thought paths that aren't your own. What is your biggest struggle with time? Take it anywhere you want. I look forward to reading your responses. Next up, let's get into this week's Masonic Minute with illustrious brother, Stephen L. Harrison.
One of the first things a newly initiated brother learns about Freemasonry is the fact that his apron is more ancient than the Golden Fleece or Roman Eagle and more honorable than the Star and Garter. The new initiate, who even in the Entered Apprentice degree kneels stunned and overwhelmed by an avalanche of information, may just let that blow right past him. It's not a real stretch to think many of our new brothers have never heard of those things. The point is to impress on the Entered Apprentice that his apron is the valuable, treasured, and even sacred badge of a Freemason. Knowing the provenance of those terms, however, makes the claim of the apron's worth even more meaningful. The Golden Fleece is, in fact, the fleece of a golden winged ram named Chrysomelus. The fleece itself is a symbol of the authority of a king. It plays a major role in the myth of Jason and the Argonauts. In that ancient tale, Peleus, king of the Greek city or province Iolcus, sends Jason on a quest where he, spoiler alert, retrieves the Golden Fleece. When he returns home with it, a nasty soap opera of power and intrigue follows. The myth may date as early as 1800 BC, with more modern versions appearing by 300 BC. In 1430, Philip of Burgundy declined to accept the Order of the Garter and created the Order of the Golden Fleece based on the story of Jason. It eventually became the most prestigious of all the knightly orders in Europe. It may be easier for the new brother to conjure up a mental picture and meaning of the Roman eagle. It is, in fact, an eagle, or in Latin, aquila. Usually cast in metal with a bronze color, it commonly sits with wings spread many times, perched above a plate engraved with the letters SPQR, standing for Senatus Populesque Romanus, the Senate and the Roman people. In ancient Rome, the eagle symbolized many things, including imperial rule, but probably most significantly, it was a symbol of a Roman military legion. Special standard bearers carried the eagle on a staff into battle and protected it with their lives. The loss of an eagle in battle was considered to be a grave tragedy. Early in the history of Rome, several animals served symbolically along with the aquila, but by about 100 BC, the eagle remained as the single national symbol. The significance of the Star and Garter is much more obscure to someone unfamiliar with it. The reference is actually to the most noble order of the Garter, an honor King Edward III established in England in 1348 and dedicated to the Virgin Mary. It is the highest British civil and military honor. The king or queen has the exclusive power to select its members. Membership includes England's sovereign, the Prince of Wales, and 24 additional living members. Honorary memberships are also available, apparently in order to minimize hurt feelings among the gentry. Members actually wear a garter, men around the left calf, and women around the left arm. The garter is inscribed "Honi soit qui mal y pense," a Middle French term meaning "shame on him who thinks evil of this." They also wear a star-shaped badge on the left side of a coat. When our ritual compares the Masonic apron to the Golden Fleece or Star and Garter, it is most likely a direct reference to the honors of the orders named for them, dating back to the 14th and 15th centuries, respectively. It must be left to Masonic historians to determine which of all these is more ancient. But for our purposes, there is no reason to doubt the correctness of our ritual. The claim that a Freemason's apron is more honorable than the Star and Garter puts it in high standing indeed. While the Order of the Garter remains today a prestigious award and has been held by many great individuals, including some brothers like Winston Churchill, it is also based on nepotism and given to some who have done nothing more deserving than to be born into the right family. It demands unswerving loyalty to England's monarch, and in many instances has been revoked. In fact, it may interest you to know that no less than 36 Knights of the Garter have been beheaded. For the Whence Came You podcast, this is Steve Harrison with the Masonic Minute.
All right, now how many of you thought out there that the Star and Garter was something to do with the United States? I have often heard this explanation that it is somehow equitable to the Star Spangled Banner, and they get mixed up, and they're totally different things, right? And this was a wonderful little history lesson on exactly what the Star and Garter is. But if also, if you didn't know what the Roman Eagle was, you got that history too. Now this was an awesome episode of the Masonic Minute. The video that goes along with it will be on our YouTube channel as well as on the Steve's YouTube channel. And I encourage you to subscribe to both. Please head on over to YouTube, like and subscribe to the videos there. As the kids, quote unquote, say today, smash that subscribe button. I sincerely ask you to check it out there also, not only to be able to catch these things on YouTube, but also we do have from time to time videos instead of just podcasts, and you get notifications when new things come out. So feel free to do that. If you like this kind of thing where Steve is talking about these cool Did You Know's histories and giving us the background on things we just kind of take in passing within the ritual, you're going to want to pick up his books. They're all linked on the WCY bookstore, which is a little page that we've got up that just links back to Amazon. They are affiliate links. I want to tell you guys that up front, but it is a win-win-win. Steve gets a sale, you get a great book, and a few pennies comes back to support the WCY podcast, and, you know, so we can bring another 500 episodes to you guys. Now, speaking of books, if you guys liked our episodes where we worked our way through ancient and modern initiation and you want to get a copy of that book, please check out the special edition that we released just this year. It's got a great little biography of Max Heindel in the beginning and also kind of a prologue at the end for you, and is a nice layout with the original images and things from the text. I invite you to check that out. You can also pick up The Master's Word, a short treatise on the Word, the Light, and the Self, which we'll have autographed. It's a book that Brother John Ruark and I worked on, and we went through the whole thing and we annotated it. I think you'll find that it's a great addition to your library. It's available on Amazon, on Kindle. You can get it autographed through our website, wcypodcast.com, or you can get it in hardcover through Amazon. And of course, how to charter a lodge. How to Charter a Lodge, a no-nonsense, unsanctioned guide, autographed, and it's got great additions from several brothers and sisters at large, you know, in Masonic communities who have done similar things to chartering a lodge. And people have asked a lot of questions about the book. Does it tell you how to do the whole thing? Yeah, that's what the book is all about, how to do it. That means how to gather the right people, how to handle difficult situations, what to expect all the way through. And I think you guys will really enjoy it. In fact, you know, we used it to charter a lodge here in Illinois, and I just used it again, you know, to charter a brand new AMD council. So often tested in a past every time. So, right, this book stands as often been tried, never denied, and being ready to be tried again. Let's go back to Brother Stephen L. Harrison for a moment. Just this last Friday, we republished an article that he published a while back, and it's called Murder and Treason Accepted, E-X-C-E-P-T-E-D, not accepted with an A, but accepted. This is a revisit. Again, Stephen L. Harrison, 33rd degree, a fellow of the Missouri Lodge of Research. Here he says, I recently produced a Benedict Arnold video for the Whence Came You podcast. The gist of the message is this. Had a wound Arnold received in the Revolutionary War's Second Battle of Saratoga been fatal, he would today be considered a great American hero. Having been appointed commander of the fort at West Point, Arnold contacted British Major John Andre, offering to surrender the fort to the British exchange for an unspecified high rank and £20,000, roughly $2.7 million or $4 million today. West Point was located on the Hudson River. Had the British taken control of the fort, they would have controlled the river and probably turned the tide of the Revolutionary War in their favor. The plan fell apart when Andre was caught and on October 2, 1780, executed as a spy. The British in turn gave Arnold the rank of Brigadier General and reduced his payment to £6,315, or £850,000, or $1.25 million today. Since the plot failed, Arnold moved to England and lived in relative obscurity until his death in 1801. The video itself, a short vignette which can be seen at the following link, doesn't tell the full story. In researching the piece, I discovered some additional things about Benedict Arnold worth sharing. Arnold was an active member of Hiram Lodge No. 1, New Haven, Connecticut. After his act of sedition, the lodge struck his name from its records, as did other lodges Arnold had visited. Benedict Arnold's father was Benedict Arnold III. He also had an older brother named Benedict Arnold. It was his family's tradition to have a son with that name in each generation. His older brother died before he was born, and the family gave him the same name. His full name, in fact, Benedict Arnold V. Arnold was a deserter in the French Indian War, even though under extenuating circumstances. He received word his mother had contracted yellow fever and left the battlefield to be with her. She died shortly after he returned home. Arnold's first profession at 21 was a shopkeeper selling medicines and books. He became a trader, a profession made difficult by the taxes the British levied to maintain the colonies. Subsequently, to avoid the taxes, he became a smuggler. He was catapulted to hero status when, together with Ethan Allen, he captured Fort Ticonderoga early in the American Revolution. He led a march in Quebec in 1775 in an effort to capture the city and make Canada the 14th colony. When General Montgomery, who was supporting him, died, the mission failed. Arnold again was considered a hero at the Battle of Valcour Island in the American Revolution. He felt he should have been promoted as a result of his victory, but others were promoted over him, beginning his resentment toward the American cause. He subsequently drove the British to the sea and was made a major general. With other less deserving men still superior to him, his resentment continued. When General Horatio Gates hesitated to advance at Saratoga, Arnold took command and defeated the British. Arnold was wounded in his left leg for the third time in his career. He clearly was responsible for the victory, but Gates snatched the glory and accepted British General Burgoyne's sword. To add further insult, Arnold was placed under arrest for disobeying orders. In order to impress the father of Peggy Shipman, he purchased a 96-acre estate and subsequently married her. The remaining money he owed on the estate sunk his finances. When he cooked up his plot to surrender West Point, he gave Major John Andre a pass to get him through the American lines. Andre was robbed. When the robbers turned patriots discovered Andre was a spy, they arrested him and showed the pass to George Washington. That tipped Washington off that Arnold was a traitor, and Washington immediately set out to arrest him. Arnold escaped with only minutes to spare. Although she knew about the plot, his wife Peggy somehow convinced Washington she was innocent. The British made Benedict Arnold a brigadier general in the British Army. Americans hated him and the British resented him. No one trusts a traitor. An apocryphal story claims George Washington was so angry at and so reviled Arnold, he decreed his name should never be written down. Subsequently, he had the gravestone of Arnold's father and brother of the same name removed. Indeed, records at Old Northtown Cemetery in Connecticut, where his father was buried, indicate gravestone removed, 1781. Also, a marker known as the Boot Monument at Saratoga Battlefield honors Arnold's heroism without naming him. The boot commemorates the wound he received in his leg without otherwise recognizing a traitor. In the end, Benedict Arnold regretted his seditious actions. Knowing he was dying, he put on his former uniform and said, "Let me die in my old American uniform, the uniform in which I fought my battles. God forgive me for ever putting on any other." It may have been a noble thought, but it's doubtful anyone, including his former brothers, chose to forgive him. After all, whether it be secrets or vile deeds, we Freemasons have a saying, murder and treason accepted. Stephen L. Harrison, 33rd degree. Well, there you go, a little bit of Americana for you, this quasi 4th of July episode, a little homage there. We'll have links back to this article as well as the videos that he spoke about in the show notes. Now let's stir up some controversy. About a month, maybe 2 months ago, good brother and friend, Brother Kevin Homan, who is a past head of his Knight Templar Commandery, wrote an interesting article. For those who read it, I think they get the point. Others, maybe not so much. Let's take a look at what Brother Kevin has to say. Breaking the Paradigms of the Knights Templar. Setting Sun or a New Dawn? A lot of Templar Knights may not like or appreciate my next statement. However, with the continued importance placed on it by the Grand Encampment and various Grand Commanderies, and given the current state of Templary, I feel it's an important topic to discuss. The Masonic Knights Templar needs to completely get rid of drill teams. There, I said it. Please keep in mind this is my statement, my opinion. I in no way officially represent my commandery, grand commandery, or the grand encampment on this blog. I'm not, however, the first Mason to make this observation. In an article he wrote several years ago, Chris Hodapp identifies it as well. Quote, "After each triennial conclave, it is usually obvious that more and more commanderies continue to lose their drill teams to attrition," end quote. Quote again, "While drilling was the national fad of the 1870s simply because 75% of the adult male population had previously been in the military, over 140 years later it holds little fascination. This in no way is meant to denigrate the dedication of the men in the drill teams," end quote. As with Chris, I'm not saying this to take a pot shot at Templary and our Sir Knights who drill. Far from it. The Templar orders are among the most beautiful order or degrees you will receive in all of Freemasonry. In this Mason's humble opinion, the Order of the Temple is the most beautiful in all of Freemasonry. When done properly, it is absolutely awe-inspiring. However, Freemasonry is dying. Templarism, even more so because of its requirements. Men are not becoming Freemasons as they did in the past. Additionally, Masons are dying off at increasing rates, further precipitating our decline. To join the Knights Templar, one must be a member of the Blue Lodge, Royal Arch Chapter, and Cryptic Council. If membership is shrinking within the Blue Lodge, numbers certainly aren't any better within the appendant bodies. In fact, it's a situation that's largely worse as you climb that ladder. Additionally, Knights Templar is quote-unquote limited, albeit overlooked just about everywhere, to Christian Freemasons only. This additional requirement can further restrict the numbers that commanderies can draw from. Additionally, and we'll get into this a bit more later in the article, is that the cost to acquire the proper regalia of the commandery is quite simply cost prohibitive for some brethren. So, in actuality, it's more than just drill teams and drill that is at issue here for Templary. However, something needs to be done if we want to survive as an organization. The earliest records we have of a Masonic Knight Templar organization is from the mid-1700s in Scotland and Ireland. While those records are rather limited, it appears that their formation is related to a speech by Michael Ramsay, who purported that the Templar Knights of the Crusades era had Masonic influence. In America, the first recorded conferral of the Order of the Temple is in 1769 on a Masonic brother named William Davis. It appears that the Order of the Temple was conferred as a part of the Royal Arch Chapter, as the fourth and final of their degrees and orders conferred in that era. But it's safe to say that some form of Templary existed in the American colonies before Brother Davis was knighted. For a more detailed history, please see both the linked articles above, as well as the Grand Encampment's own Our Templar Heritage in the United States link. Templary, though, grew rather slowly and for some time was loosely or not organized at all. The oldest encampment, what we would now call a commandery, we have recorded of existed in Charleston, South Carolina. It's not until 1853, just 8 short years before the Civil War, that the General Grand Encampment was formed. Eventually, this is shortened to the Grand Encampment, and state-level grand encampments became referred to as grand commanderies, and our existing organizational form comes into place. Like Freemasonry, membership numbers in Templary have had their peaks and valleys. Some of the earliest numbers in the early 1800s peg it at about 500 Sir Knights about 50 years later, just after the formation of the General Grand Encampment, 4,710. Following Masonic trends during the World War I and II eras, in 1927, we see the highest number of Sir Knights ever recorded at 453,836, dropping to just 219,368 in 1943, and then increasing again to 398,564 in 1960. From that date, however, Templary has seen a steady decline in its membership since. I attempted to find a recorded history on drill teams and competitions within American Templary, but the records are rather sparse. In a recent letter sent out by my Grand Commander, though, history of drill in general and a history of drill in my home state is discussed. As Brother Hodapp identifies in the article I reference above, drill likely worked its way in because it was a faddish thing to do at the time Templary was going through one of its initial growth periods, and somebody thought it was a good thing to work into what we do as an organization. In terms of general drill, my Grand Commander refers back to drill, or a regular marching step, going back to the Roman legions, which carried over to European armies and, of course, our American military to this day. We then go on to talk about how, in the late 1990s, my particular Grand Commander resurrected our drill team and has continued to grow since this resurgence. We close off our history of drill in general with this statement, quote, "New research shows that when groups march in unison, it not only intimidates enemies, if that is the desire, but also gives the marching group a confidence boost," end quote. I mean, that's all well and good, but Freemasonry isn't Tony Robbins. We're looking to make good men better, not their life coach. When you look at Templar descriptions of drill teams, you often see words and phrases such as development of teamwork, pride in themselves and their unit, confidence, alterness, attention to detail, esprit de corps, discipline, etc. Now, these are all good terms, don't get me wrong, but again, what does any of it have to do with Freemasonry or Christianity? The answer is nothing. Freemasonry as a spiritual organization is supposed to unite men of faith and aid them in strengthening those spiritual bonds and ties. One would think, as a Christian-oriented Masonic organization, the Knights Templar would unite men of the Christian faith and aid them in doing the same, albeit within the confines of their Christian faith and our belief in Christ. This is not the experience we get these days, though. If you were to go to the average monthly Templar conclave, you would see a meeting opening that takes roughly 30 minutes, quite often with mediocre work. If you're lucky, you'll see some of the past commanders fighting over what constitutes proper drill. Like every other Masonic meeting, we then get our business, pay the bills, complain about something, then close the meeting. On rare occasions do you get a program of substance. More often than not, though, the program will be on Jacques de Molay, the fall of the Templars, or something tangentially related. I can't say I've ever sat through an actual Christian program in a Knights Templar conclave. Now, our Grand Commanderies and the Grand Encampment are well aware of the issues facing us. The question is, what are they doing to combat it? And are those efforts working? At both levels, strategic plans are formulated to engage the membership, recruit the next generation, yada, yada, yada. The reality is, it's all just a rehashing of the same old ideas this organization has been living and dying for 200 years. One I can't help but think is doomed to fail. In 2019, I was eminent commander of my commandery. One of the efforts our Grand Commandery pushed, one they continue to push, was the idea of having each of the constituent commanderies register the 6 Sir Knights with Grand Commandery as the quote-unquote commandery drill team. More recently, an email with a series of propositions, resolutions, and informal sheets was sent out to all commanderies. In our quote-unquote The Drill Corps Drill Team Activity Recognition Manual, the Introduction and Purpose section of the document opens with the following statements. Quote, membership is the most critical issue to all bodies within Freemasonry, which includes the Knights Templar. Drill team activities support both membership recruiting and membership retention efforts. How? Where is your data to back this up? Because I respectfully disagree with this. As I mentioned, our Grand Commandery mandates we report a group of Sir Knights to them as our official drill team, but then later in this document makes the following statement, quote, drill team and drill-related activities are not mandatory, nor should they be, end quote. It sure seems to me that they're trying to have their cake and eat it too. We claim interest in drill continues to grow. We commission new badges for our Templar uniforms as incentives for Sir Knights to join the Drill Corps, but none of it is working. The reality is, the new Sir Knights who are looking to join aren't interested in drilling or a military aspect to their Freemasonry. Yet over and over, year after year, commanderies, grand commanderies, and the Grand Encampment continue to ignore that reality and instead throw quote-unquote solutions at the problem that are the Masonic equivalent of slapping a Band-Aid on an injury that requires amputation. Knights Templar is woefully out of touch with present conditions. If men were truly interested in drill, well, they'd be knocking on doors asking about it, and we wouldn't have an issue filling our drill teams. But that's just not happening. I can't tell if our ignorance is true ignorance or just a stubbornness born out of wanting to not change and adapt to the times. I suspect it's the latter. But drill isn't the only issue we face. If you were to ask Masons what the biggest obstacle to them joining the Knights Templar, the two popular answers you'll hear back are either with regards to our uniform or the Christian requirement. More on this shortly. The current Templar uniform is a quite expensive uniform to put together, and for those Masons of modest means, potentially just out of their financial reach. Now, some of you may say, but commanderies are supposed to have an armorer and outfit their Sir Knights. Yes, some do, most don't, and those that do have armories likely dating back to the 1960s or so, with gear largely unfit for use. As with our grand Masonic edifices we built, little to no effort went into the maintenance of the equipment, so it shouldn't be a wonder that it's in a condition unfit for use. We brought in members, filled up our coffers, spent money because we had it to burn, then did nothing from there on out. The uniform itself looks nice, albeit a little silly because of the chapeau we wear. In my case, I spent about $400 on my uniform, which is the U.S. Navy dress blues double-breasted black suit, and about the same on my chapeau. That's $800 right there. Not an insignificant sum of money. My commandery is lucky in that we have a nice set of swords for the Sir Knights to use, as well as a beautiful sword that each eminent commander gets to wear during his year in office. However, for a past commander such as myself, if I'd like a sword to wear as a past commander, since they are of course different and often customized, that's about another $500. With a Masonic experience that is lacking as most Masonic experiences are these days, plus an estimated $1,300 in purchases to participate in and be an officer of your commandery, is it any wonder that men aren't joining our commanderies these days? Now, there is also a very nice-looking cap and mantle uniform option, which, in my opinion, looks very nice and is much more in keeping with what the actual Templar Knights would have worn. But again, why do we even need a uniform in the first place? Militarism isn't a part of Freemasonry. Why do we feel the need to add it here? At the Grand Encampment level, on its website, the phrase, "Every Christian Mason should be a Knight Templar," is splashed across the page below our mission and vision statements. As with the claim that drill aids in membership recruitment and retention, let me ask again, why? What is it that the Grand Encampment and Knights Templar as a whole offers Christian Masons that aids them in deepening and connecting further with their faith? Surely it's not drill. Surely it's not the opportunity to pay $1,300 for a uniform and a body that offers men nothing to connect with their Christian faith. I'm sure if I were to ask one of the Grand Encampment officers that same question, I'd get a similar response if I were to ask the Grand Lodge officer what their plan on membership is. Quote, "Well, that's on you as individual Sir Knights and Commanderies to figure out," end quote. Plain and simple, they pass the buck because there is no plan other than ignoring the raging fire all around us. Apple didn't get to be Apple because Steve Jobs allowed the individual business components of Apple to have their own business plans. No. Steve Jobs had a unified vision for Apple that each department followed to their current success. That is what the Grand Encampment and Grand Commanderies lack, a unified vision, and more importantly, a plan to implement that vision across the organization from the top down. All they've given us instead is a catchy phrase with no substance behind it. The question I ultimately have is, where do we want to go from here? Does the Knights Templar want to survive? I mean, Freemasonry as a whole may not survive, so the peril for Templary is even greater. Assuming we do, though, I'd start with a wholesale rebrand of this organization. Let's drop the Christian requirement of membership. Let's make Templary a Masonic body of research for topics of all religions, not just Christianity. Freemasonry is a faith-based organization. We unite men of all faiths, and we're supposed to guide them on a journey to strengthen those bonds. What better than having an organization that allows us as men of faith and other faiths to do just that? Now, I realize what I just said is quite likely a non-starter and quite likely to make many Sir Knights uncomfortable. But drastic times often call for drastic measures. Those of us who came of age in the late 90s and early 2000s quite likely carried around a Nokia cell phone of some sort. Did you know that before Nokia produced cell phones, they were a producer of paper products? Yes, paper products. Quite the pivot, isn't it? If we absolutely can't drop the Christian requirement, why not do the same for Christian Masons? Become the de facto Christian research body of Christian Masons? There's so much out there to be learned about Christianity that I feel like it's a ripe topic for us to pick. Follow the Lodge of Research model and set the brethren loose. What we can't do, however, is what we continue to do, and that's blindly throw solutions at a problem I don't think our leadership understands. I've never seen one survey from my Grand Commandery or the Grand Encampment soliciting Sir Knight's opinions on what they want to get out of Templary. Instead of commissioning a badge or mandating compliance of drill rosters, perform that survey and find out why those drill team numbers are so low. Whatever we do, we must do something, anything different, if we're to at least stabilize. Again, drastic measures, drastic solutions. I'm sure it was easy for Pepsi to come up with the marketing for Crystal Pepsi. However, like any product release, the marketing is just half the battle. The true measure of success is how you implement that product. We all know how that worked out for Pepsi. This is where Masonic Templary is. Great pitch line, but we're giving our Sir Knights Crystal Pepsi. A Masonic friend of mine had an observation as I was writing this and discussing the article with him. The main draw initially of Crystal Pepsi was curiosity, but when buyers found out it tasted like regular Pepsi, well, they just bought that. Masonic Templarism was very similar to him. If he wanted church, he'd just go to church. If he wanted Freemasonry, he'd just go to Blue Lodge. After attending one Templar conclave, he's never been back, as the experience didn't match the marketing. If we want to survive as an organization, the same old story isn't going to cut it anymore. What is it that the young men who are looking to join want to get out of the Templar experience? As we currently exist as an organization, are we offering them that? If we don't offer that, how are we going to offer that to entice them to join, and more importantly, keep them in our commanderies when they do join? I know what I'd do if I were running things. The question is, do we as Sir Knights and an organization have the fortitude to ask those hard questions and implement those hard solutions? At this point, our survival depends on some drastic change. Kevin Homan, past Eminent Commander. Well, there you have a really interesting article about, that starts on this talk about a drill team. And the issue comes in as drill, and you're like, well, who cares about drill? And then as I said that, I'm like, oh, I'm proving this article right now. Very interesting article. How do you all feel about Templar Masonry? I mean, it seems to be one of those things. I joined, I went through the degrees, I pay my dues every year, but I've not gone back, but maybe once or twice. And this entire kind of thing, you know, the reason I don't go is because it's actually 45 minutes away. There's not one that's closer. And I'm already an officer and other things, and I just don't want to give additional time to Templary when I can spend that time doing things with my family, right? Like, we need to have some separation. Can't take on all the roles. And as Kevin has pointed out, you know, 30 minutes to open, and you need, I think, 13 people to be there for an opening, and it's very involved, and it needs its people, right? Like, you want to respect the organization enough to allow it to work, and if you're going to be a part of it, then you should be somebody who works in it, at least to help it out. But I can't dedicate that. And my dollars aren't the only thing that keeps this organization open. So what are we going to do? I'm certainly not going to join drill. And that's just not my thing. I'm not a big military guy. This is super interesting to me. He asks some great questions. And Kevin and I are around the same age, so we have some similar thought process on how we think and how we grew up and what we have interest in. And he's pretty correct in assuming what young men are looking for and what they're not looking for. And this just seems like drill being this thing that we were identifying Templary with. And by removing it, are we not Templary anymore? I'm not sure. But my question for all of the Craftsman Plus out there, I guess we'll open it up to everybody, even if you're not a Knight Templar, right? Number one, as if you are a Knight Templar, say so and let us know, how would you feel about some of the changes that Brother Homan has offered? If you're not a Templar, tell us why. And if any of the changes that Kevin mentioned would entice you to join. I'm curious to hear your answers. As usual, links back to this article will be in the show notes as well. That's it for this week. I want to thank you all for joining me on this week's education. Happy 4th of July. I hope you had a good one. And you didn't lose any limbs by blowing off your fingers or anything. Keep your eyes and ears and thumbs reactive, because pretty soon you're going to see some dates for the Initiation of Plato, a live dramatized table read with a great cast. And we're getting together to do our dates very soon. So with that, I'll talk to you all next week. Until then, stay on the level. For Whence Came You, I'm Robert Johnson. Take care.
You've been listening to Whence Came You, a Masonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry with your host, Brother Robert Johnson. Be sure to join us for our next edition.